The Future Professional Podcast, a conversational catalyst for our future.
Clinicians, we are like data monsters. We want to know everything about the patient.
I think doctors who are going to be replaced are the ones that are scared of technology.
The return of investment won't be immediate. It never will be in healthcare.
I don't think the data is incorrect. I think the interpretation can be incorrect.
Today's host is...
I'm Dr. Steve Madigana. I am a medical doctor and a health executive as well, but I prefer to call myself a digital health innovator, and I've been GQ's best raised in 2016.
In conversation with...
Dr. Mpazi Tswale. I'm a surgical medical officer at Charlotte MacGregor Hospital. I'm also a master's candidate in healthcare data at the University of Cambridge.
I'm Takaran Majaji. By profession, I'm an actuary, but currently I run a data science / AI company.
Today's topic...
Big data and artificial intelligence in the healthcare sector.
Let's get started.
I'm joined by two amazing individuals, Takalani Majaji and Mpazi Tswale. What is data and what is data in the context of healthcare as a whole?
I like to look at it from the point of view that data could be absolutely anything depending on who wants to use it. In the sense that data could be as basic or as granular as what you get from the patient, what we see. And then you could step back, how does the ward in which the patient is sitting function? You can take it a bit wider and get data from the hospital and what are the different departments, the way patients are moving through the hospital, flowing through the hospital, and in business cases, how money flows through the hospital. And you can take it even wider at a population level. What is the data like in this region, in this country, in the world? So really, when I look at data and healthcare data specifically, right, as a clinician, I look at all forms of data which increase or better the well-being of a person. But it's much broader than that, and it really could be anything. Anything which helps us improve the health of one person, a population, a system, anything.
And we measure a lot of these things. So, for example, when a patient gets into the hospital, we get their age, their demographic information,
exactly,
but also disease outcome stuff that we measure. So why is that important for us to even measure those things?
If you take it down to the bedside, right? Us clinicians, we are like data monsters. We want to know everything about the patient. What did they eat? When did they present? When did these symptoms start? How severe were they? What are the blood pressures? What are the pulses? What are the sugars? In order to treat the patient at the bedside, the more data we have, the better we can act upon it and treat the patient. But in the same context, as a public health specialist, you might want to know how many patients are presenting with lung disease from this area in the country. And that might help you plan. It might help you budget better. It might help you prevent disease, right? And the way you monitor outbreaks and see if you can contain. And you could see how it was successful in some parts of the world. So the possibility is actually endless.
So we capture all this data, and how has this data always been captured?
I think it goes back to, if we go back to before 1920, my understanding is that everything was transcribed on paper. And then it's when computers started coming in that there was that need to capture it digitally. But it was the catalyst for you to get there was actually the introduction of your medical aid or your medical insurance, because then they needed to get the data done. And then with the World Health Organization being introduced with your ICD, the 10 codes and everything like that, then it was a requirement now. You need to actually have data captured properly. And so we're seeing healthcare data being captured digitally over time. And then what's interesting actually about healthcare data is that more than a third of the healthcare data that we have has only been captured since 2015.
It's important to note that we've had all of this data that people capture, and even till this day, a lot of the stuff that are captured in clinics, in Joburg clinics, and in different municipalities is still captured manually. Why has it taken us such a long time for us to translate those things into like a digital system? Whereas if you look at other industries and engineering in other sectors, the transformation has taken much, much quicker.
If you look at examples across the world, in countries which are far ahead in terms of digital maturity, the biggest catalyst in clinicians and healthcare systems adopting these electronic health records was actually money. In quite a large number of cases, you know. Once the money is there, everyone's willing to do it, right? Because doctors and everyone alike were not averse to technology. I mean, I've got 1,001 gadgets. What's stopping me from using a gadget in the hospital? It's really just the hospital and the system paying for it, right? Because the problem is that A lot of these systems are very bespoke. Some are actually using proprietary software. And only now there are some efforts worldwide to have open source record keeping, open source systems and APIs which you can plug in and play with. If you look at, like, for example, in the US, the biggest driver of change of adoption of healthcare records was when Obama signed in the Affordable Care Act with the high-tech portion of it, where the government then put in capital and incentivized physicians and hospital systems to take up these electronic health records. And I mean, they went from, I think it was about 12% in 2009 to now it's 96% uptake of electronic healthcare records. And we saw the same thing in the GP sector in the UK. So when it comes to Africa, the developing world, a little bit is about money. But there is also the issue of change and adaptive change amongst us clinicians, you know, because it's one thing moving from writing and then the next day someone tells you, okay, no more writing, you have to now use this system and the training involved and the change of workflows and stuff. But I believe that that shouldn't be a problem. You know, it's one day, soon. We're already going there. You know, a lot of systems have already taken up electronic health.
Can I add into that? Can I ask you, so you guys are doctors, right? So just assume you are doing your rounds, right? What's easier, to type or to write?
Definitely write. Well, I mean,
Mbazi, you're saying definitely write because that's the kind of honors indoctrination, but that's how we were taught as students.
Yeah. Our training has been handwritten, right? And oftentimes the way doctors put their thoughts to paper, it's hashes and arrows here and drawing. It's very unique. Shorthand, you know, things which are not very easy to type, you know. What we've looked at, like what I was during our studies, you found that change is not difficult, but you have to lay it out before everyone. The systems which found it very hard to make the digital change, they almost had these systems dropped on them. And all of a sudden, you have a specialist has been working one way for years with good outcomes. And then some IT guy comes the next day and tells him, no, you have to do it like this. And you can already sense the resistance. But in successful transformations or digital transformation projects, once you lay it out and say, this is what the technology can do, and how best can you fit it to your current workflows? They found that the digital transformation was then much faster. So it's an issue of technical change versus adaptive change, right? And if you lean more to adaptive change, right, digital transformation
is
much smoother.
There's actually a technical reason for why the adoption in the medical field has been quite slow. So if you look at the type of data that is collected in medical, it's actually unstructured.
Okay. Exactly.
So 60% of it is unstructured. So it's handwriting, it's all of those things, mm-hmm. right? But what has happened is that technology has not been supporting unstructured data a lot.
Okay, so it's the input that you need that's going to be structured.
So for example, if I then get, you know how your Samsung works, right? So if I can, you can do your shorthand and everything, and it then translated to a normal thing, and then it then transferred to a digital record, then it's easier.
When you're collecting all of this data, whether it's hospitals, whether it's your smartwatches, all of these things then create what we call big data, because there's a lot of it. There's a lot of information to be captured. What happens to that information?
It depends on who's collecting the data, right? So whoever is collecting the data, and if you're giving them permission to collect the data, then the data belongs to them. For example, what's happening on your iWatch, it belongs to you, but then you can give Apple the rights to either distribute it to a third party or not. So that depends. However, because health data is so personal, and we've moved to an age where if you know who I am and how my heart rate, my health history, there are ethical issues to it, where now it becomes very different from collecting data about how many flights I take or where I go to every day in the morning. It's very different from collecting health data.
Yeah, this is where, for example, in South Africa, the Poppy Act comes in that you can't just distribute people's information to anyone unless it's assigned to you. So we've got this big data. How does it then plug in the field of artificial intelligence? I think let's take it one step back. What is AI actually?
AI is basically training machines, i.e. computers, to be able to have human intelligence. And human intelligence is the ability to recognize speech, as we're speaking at the moment, the ability to see, the ability to reason. So that is artificial intelligence in such a broad definition. And then you then have narrow AI, and then you've got general AI. And narrow AI is basically, which is where we are as the world, right? Basically, you then train a computer to do one thing and it does it very well. Whereas general AI is basically then a computer program or an algorithm of or technology can do more than one thing.
There's a project that I'm working with. Currently, they collect the beneficiary's information by doing qualitative questions. One of the questions that we were tasked with is, what one physical indicator from a health perspective can you use to look at someone's health? And the question of like your eye came out, and I still don't know how that applies.
Okay, so I know that if you've got your doctors, you will correct me, right? You can tell if someone has liver issues with the eye, right? And the type of liver issue that they have, depending on how the eye, the color and everything like that. So how AI would then, you then collect lots and lots of different pictures of the eye. And then you'll then classify, this is, let's say this is jaundice, right? And this is not jaundice. Then you train the algorithm to recognize when someone has jaundice and not jaundice, right? So now you've got this application on your phone, or which got this AI model. So I can then go take a picture of your eye, and then because it has seen so many different types of eyes, it will then tell you whether you've got jaundice or you don't have jaundice. And that's narrow AI, because you've taught it to be able to recognize when someone has jaundice and whether they don't have jaundice.
How does this then help with patient outcomes? How does it help you and me in terms of our healthcare?
I can give you another famous example from a company called DeepMind. What they did in their systems was that they looked at predicting acute kidney injury in hospitalized patients. And this was a classic example where artificial intelligence actually led to better outcomes. So in that case, what they did is that they, as an ongoing thing, collected thousands and thousands of data points from hospitalized patients. The artificial intelligence had been trained before to look at the subtle markers which may predict that this patient is likely to get acute kidney injury. And they do that based on the fact that someone had kidney injury and what happened before. The AI was able to predict acute kidney injury in patients 48 hours before an experienced clinician could. And that directly translated to us preventing it and preventing bad outcomes for a patient. And that's one of the most famous and I think a very classic example of how teaching these systems, right, giving them all this big data, and then you train it, and it's synthesizing all these data points, and it comes up with predictive models, and it's able to then tell us, give us foresight to be like, this patient is about to get sick, act now. And we save lives just like that.
Essentially, it's improving the clinician's acumen in order to save that patient's life.
We like to say augmenting.
Okay, augmenting, yeah. So it's augmenting the current service that I provide as a doctor, but also from the patient's perspective, you know that your outcomes technically should become better. So does that mean that we won't need doctors in the future? We won't need doctors, we won't need nurses, we won't need... I mean, if you can train a machine to do this, why would I still need Dr. Sewale to come and diagnose me?
I think doctors who are going to be replaced are the ones that are scared of technology. So the ones that don't know how to use it to augment their skills. For example, when now the patient is now in there, you're seeing the acute kidney failure, now you're in panic mode, like, let's save this person, let's do this. Instead of, if you know that before, you can now plan and now actually work on, how do I save the person? How do I make sure that it doesn't happen? So you're now actually now advancing yourself as a human race to then say, what is the next step? Instead of that, just dealing with the issue now, you're always on crisis mode. Do you see what I mean? So it's there to actually accelerate human experience. If you can.
I like that example. I could give you another one, right? We know in Africa we have a shortage of doctors, point blank. And what AI systems like this can do is that they can take off quite a bit of workload from us, right? You can imagine a clinic which is not run by a doctor but run by AI for relatively simple cases, you know, your hypertension, blood pressure. So the AI checks your sugar, the AI checks your blood pressure, adjusts to a certain extent. And then once the case becomes more complex, then your cardiologist can step in. And what that can do is that it can allow this limited resource we have to be focused on the more complex tasks, you know, as Sakalani said. I think we're going to see a future where we're going to work hand in hand with artificial intelligence, right, and use it to our benefit and for the patients as well.
I mean, look, I completely agree. I think healthcare is such a personalized space. It's, you almost need that human touch, even though now we're doing consultations through telemedicine portals. You don't actually need a human being to be physically there in order to do this. But indulge me for a second. It almost sounds like all of these things that you're talking about, it's very affluent, high up in the ceiling, when we're talking about someone who's living in rural KZN, and how will this apply to them?
So let's look at one thing, right? Mobile phone penetration in Africa is about 90%+. In some places, 100 and over 100%. You know, people have got 2-3 phones. That could be our inlet to this. It's the mobile technology like that is something which I think is probably the starting point for us to be able to spread this technology to everyone. Within a few years, right, a simple phone would be your hub of artificial intelligence. I mean, an iPhone already has, they claim it has all sorts of neural networks in it. And I'm not saying anyone can own an iPhone, but 5 years down the line, probably every other phone might have it. So it may not be up in the sky, right? I don't think it's too far off. I think we're on the cusp, and if anything, because we're kind of mobile first in Africa, we'll probably be primed to actually take advantage of these technologies relatively quickly because it's in the palm of your hand. I think there was an example in the, was it NBA players who were wearing this ring, one of those Halo rings, to monitor temperature, for example, right? Your capabilities are just, they are as great as what you can measure, really. So it's just a matter of time, as you said. First thing, it's a ECG. Next thing, we can take a heart attack. Next thing, we're checking your temperatures. Next thing, we've got a continuous glucose monitor of some kind. We can monitor your coordination and watch out for neurological symptoms and Parkinson's, you know, just by the way your phone or a little ring or something with some kind of gyroscope moves on your body. And I think there was another example, a study which I saw where the use of your mobile phone was tied to your mental health, in that when you are happy, you use your mobile phone in with a certain pattern, and then when you feel a little bit depressed, you use it in a different pattern. And an artificial intelligence system was able to pick that up when all the data is collected, obviously correlating with what the clinician has said. And that could have then given the clinician a lead, and maybe this person needs to come in, right, before the symptoms worsen.
Quick question, actually. Is the data ever wrong?
I don't think the data is incorrect. I think
our interpretation is.
The interpretation can be incorrect. So if you are if my temperature is 36.2, it's 36.2, right? But if I build a model that says if your temperature is moving this way, it means you've got a particular disease or something, that you need to build in the fact that there's an error rate, that you can get something wrong in the prediction of it. So, and that's why machines will never replace humans.
When you talk about the interaction between technology and humanity, where do you think that sweet spot is?
In terms of a sweet spot between human interaction and the medical profession and our commitment to heal, where technology can take away some of the inconvenient parts of healthcare for both the doctor and the patient, and then allow the doctor-patient relationship to be free of all that. So it's in the long drive you have to take to the GP to get a simple repeat script after 6 months, and now you must wait in line for 5 hours. You take that away with technology. And because now your doctor doesn't have to deal with all the repeat scripts, he then can spend more than 15 minutes with the young patient who needs that attention now and is now not under pressure from having to do the less convenient tasks. I think that's where we're going to find the balance, because you always want your physician, your doctor, to be there for you, to focus on you, spend the time. But there are times when what you need is a quick bite of knowledge and not so much time. And if you can put technology right in the middle there, I think that's a sweet spot we're going to get to.
So I'm a socialist at heart. Our goal, and especially in South Africa, in the attainment of equitable, accessible, and quality healthcare, lowering the cost of healthcare, however, still maintaining the same quality and increasing accessibility. How do you see the role of big data and AI in us achieving this?
When you look at quality of healthcare, I think what we look at mostly is health outcomes. And I think there are already numerous examples, even just as we've talked about today, where you can increase the outcomes you have from either technology augmenting a doctor's capability to recognize patterns, either expanding the capabilities of healthcare practitioners as is, or detecting things before they happen, preventing things. But as I said earlier, these systems do cost money. The return of investment won't be immediate. It never will be in healthcare, right? So over time, as people are healthier, are able to contribute more to the economy, are out of the hospital more and at home and being treated out of our big hospitals, those should eventually add up to less spending, less wastage in our institutions. And over time, the cost savings should then make up for the upfront cost of these systems. Not to mention that they will become cheaper, I believe. I think the benefits, they're there to be seen, but you have to make a commitment to it.
For me, it's that value-based healthcare model, in that the healthier your population is, they're healthier for a longer period of time, the more we can reduce the cost of them attaining that healthcare.
Yeah.
I think that's what I got from what you're saying.
Yeah. One of the big concepts people like to talk about is scalability. And you can imagine if you have these artificial intelligence systems working alongside medical professionals, you are now able to almost, you know, quote unquote, scale the capabilities of the system. Because now, one doctor, as I said before, one doctor could see 50 patients in a clinic in a day. But the AI could see 50,000 at a time. You've just scaled the capabilities of the doctor. And all of a sudden, you have spread healthcare further and faster for the cost of one doctor. And well, and maybe the computer, but yes.
You know. And you made the doctor more efficient. I think that's another thing.
Exactly.
So, to me, healthcare has three facets to it, right? So you then have the patient, then there's you, the doctor, and then the operation, the doctor and the pharmacists and all of those, and then you've got the hospital itself. So for me, as Takalani, as a patient, it reduces my cost, because if I can just talk to a bot and pay $100 and get the simple diagnosis or a referral, in terms of value, right? If it's just a normal common cold, then I didn't have to pay 500, 600 rands to just see a doctor. And then from the clinician's perspective, I think a simple and a quick one would be, you know, how long it takes to do a medical trial and to find the right combination of medication, right? So, but if you've got enough data and you can train an AI model to say, okay, if you combine these chemicals, they will tend to treat this, then it halves or even shortens the time in which you can actually find your medication or a solution or like a cure to something, right? And for me, if you look at the operational part of the hospital, for example, one of the models that we're building is a model that will then determine how many people you need on the floor. So you don't have an offer stop in a situation where you have more nurses or doctors than you need, or less nurses than doctors that you need. Because you know this is the time of the day and the what, then you can then say, okay, I think we need only 5 doctors on this ward, or you need 5 nurses on this ward. So you see, and then you then control your costs. And I think collectively, then that whole will then reduce the cost of healthcare. And yes, there's that initial, what is this thing, outlay, right? For example, you remember the first computer which had actually like 1 megabyte of memory, like was beyond expensive. In your picture, it's like 1 megabyte of memory. But now we've got a laptop or your phone, right, that has gigs and gigs of data. And it's so over time, the cost will reduce, and then you're still going to have like non-tangible reduction in costs, right?
Look, gentlemen, thank you so much for the conversation. So for me, really, my take-home message is that these are not unattainable things, because when we're discussing big data, we're discussing AI in healthcare, it almost seems like this far-fetched idea that even as like individuals outside of health, it seems like this big, massive thing, but it's actually literally collecting data, synthesizing that data in order to help you as a person live better. That's what I came from it. Any last words?
People would be surprised just how ubiquitous artificial intelligence is already, and the difference it's making in healthcare already at the moment, right? I think popular media might have portrayed it as some far-fetched Skynet talking to you and trying to take over the hospital, when in actual fact, it's the use of all this data which we've been collecting for years. And it's been sitting in all these silos and these data warehouses and data lakes and stuff. and just looking back at it now, and then also taking that knowledge and then going forward, trying to see where can we improve, where could we do things better, right? Or where can we see something coming? For me, it's just the knowledge that this is happening already. We're already using it all the time, and we're only going to use it more and hopefully lead to better outcomes.
I think AI is here too. AI is here, right? It's not in a science fiction thing that we're still going to see. It is here. Mm. It is. It's around us. It's just going to get a little more visible the more we, you know, as time goes on. And secondly, AI is not here to take over. AI is here to assist, right? Be it in healthcare, be it in whatever industry. We need to now start looking at things differently and shifting our minds to say, how do I use AI, how do I use data to make myself an effective professional or an effective citizen?
All right, thank you very much.
The Future Professional Podcast, a conversational catalyst for our future. Listen to the latest episodes on profmed.co.za. Profmed, intelligent medical aid for professionals.